Welcome, everybody, welcome back to your old university. I think it's kind of appropriate that we're going to be looking at the topic of empathy in a law faculty. And I'm very impressed with you arriving at an early hour in the morning to listen to a topic like this. I'm going to start by just acknowledging that the research you're going to hear about is the result of collaboration. So I work in the Department of Psychiatry and also Department of Experimental Psychology in the university. But I work with teams of people, and you can see here lots of names, and it's really just because I owe it to them that we actually get research done. So we have a group of people who are psychologists and also involved in brain scanning down at Adam Brooks, and we have a second team of people who work in the field of hormones and genetics. And part of what I'm going to be leading you towards is the idea that empathy, which we think of as a very human capacity, a very important capacity for social relationships, may not just be the result of our upbringing, but may be part of our evolutionary heritage. So I should start really with what do we mean by empathy? And I think that to talk about somebody having empathy, we really need to recognise two distinct components. And unless you've got both of them, you can't really say that you have empathy. So the first one, psychologists call cognitive. It's really the understanding element, or the recognition element. So I've defined that part as the drive to identify what somebody else is thinking or feeling. It's that ability to put yourself into somebody else's shoes and to imagine their thoughts and feelings. So that bit, I think, comes first. But by itself, I don't think that adds up to empathy. I think the second part is what psychologists call the affective, or the emotional reactive element, which is the drive to respond with an appropriate feeling to somebody else's thoughts and feelings. And I think you need to separate both, because I think if you just had this laser isn't very visible, but if you just had this first element, the cognitive part, if you could recognize that somebody else was in pain, for example, as an emotion, but it left you cold, and it didn't move you to do anything about it, I think we'd all agree that that didn't count as empathy. So just recognition alone isn't enough. There has to also be some drive within you to respond appropriately. So if the other person was showing pain, it would be inappropriate to have an emotion like pleasure, but it would be entirely appropriate to want to alleviate that person's distress, to want to go over and help them or comfort them. So I think empathy has to have both of those two components. And what we're going to be looking at through a series of psychiatric portraits, really, is how some people might lose one or other of those components and why that might be the case. But the other concept I wanted to get across is the idea that empathy, both of those two components, might be on a spectrum. We're all familiar with the notion of a bell curve, the idea that that there are individual differences in many characteristics and many skills in the population, that the majority of people will fall right in the centre of the bell curve, but that there'll be individual differences right along a spectrum. And we're familiar with the concept of a bell curve when it comes to height, for example, where we can visibly see individual differences, or abilities like IQ or athleticism. And we take it for granted that there will just be these individual differences. We don't all have as much as others. And that we can identify averages in the population. But I think the same thing applies to empathy, that we have to start recognising that we don't all have as much as others in the population. Some have more, some have less. An average amount of empathy might be just fine to get by in society, but part of what I'm going to be looking at is what happens when you have too little. And then towards the end, we'll bring in the whole question of where empathy has come from, the evolution of empathy. But just to sort of make this very concrete, we've got a photograph here, which is rather poor quality. I apologise, but I thought it was important to start with this, because this is an example, I think, of what happens when we lose our empathy, but in this case at a societal level. So this was an experiment conducted by some Nazi scientists in the Dachau concentration camp, and it's called the freezing water immersion experiment, where inmates of the concentration camp during the Second World War were subjected to scientific experiments to test how long human beings could stay alive in freezing water. And these two scientists, you can see one's a professor and the other is a doctor, would time how long people could stay in freezing water, and in some cases kept people in freezing water as long as 3 hours. Now, part of this was for scientific reasons, as I said. Obviously, these inmates weren't there voluntarily. They weren't giving their consent. We all know the history of how they came to be in these camps. But what interested me when I read about this experiment was the idea that even people in the medical and scientific professions were willing to treat people as objects for reasons of scientific curiosity. So what happened to their empathy, their human compassion, when they saw another person suffering under these extreme conditions? It's very interesting, actually, that when I went to... in my first lectureship, I taught at St Mary's Hospital in London, and came across this experiment because the lecturer there in physiology presented it as part of the data that medical students are still taught with, that we learned a lot from these experiments. We learned about how to revive people from freezing water. We learned what happens in terms of physiological response when you're subjected to freezing. So from a medical point of view, we learned a lot, but I would argue the experiment itself, whatever we gained from it, was inherently unethical because the individuals conducting the experiment lost their compassion, their empathy for another person. So I've already hinted at this idea of treating people as objects, that maybe this is right at the crux of what happens when you lose your empathy. Obviously, people are not just objects. We are objects in terms of our physics. You can study us to see whether we float or whether we thrive or whether we die. But we're not just objects, we're also subjects in the sense that we have feelings. And Martin Buber was an Austrian philosopher who was very interested in this topic and famously came up with the idea that we can either have relationships with another person where we treat them as subjects, what he called I-you relationships, where you're thinking about the person as a person, or you can treat a person as an object, I-it relationships. For those of you who speak German, you can see the original distinction up there. And he argued that as soon as you turn a person into an object, an it rather than a you, you're dehumanizing them. You're no longer treating them as a person, and it's a very thin end of the wedge. Once we start doing that to any degree, there's a risk that we'll end up doing what we saw in that Nazi experiment. Interestingly, Buber resigned his professorship at the University of Frankfurt in 1933 when Hitler came to power, just in personal protest, because he could already see what was on the agenda, the political agenda, when Jews were not being allowed to hold jobs in the public sector, for example. So I want to sort of explore in the next part of this lecture the idea that there are different ways that you can lose your empathy. So the idea is we all have it, but different conditions might mean that we can lose it. And what you can see here is the consequences of what happens when you lose your empathy, that it affects your social relationships, how you treat people, whether you can even understand another person's feelings and thoughts. It affects your communication, because to communicate you really need to be imagining your words from the other person's perspective, imagining the impact of your words, but also keeping track of what the other person needs to know and how they're feeling whilst you're talking. And we can sort of summarise this as that key to every interaction should be that we're imagining another person's mind, that when we're looking at another person, we're not just seeing them as an object, we're entering their mind imaginatively to try and imagine what they might be thinking or feeling, and that when you lose your empathy, you effectively lose that skill. So what are the different ways that you can lose it? Well, working in a psychiatry department, I thought I'd start with human contemporary examples where people come to the attention of clinicians, and I would argue that whatever behaviour they're showing, at the core of this is that they have lost their empathy. So the first one, the first way in which you can lose your empathy is what many of you may have heard of, the clinical condition of borderline personality disorder. And you can see I've got a picture of Marilyn Monroe up there, because many of you know that her life was very troubled, that despite her fame and her glamour, she was in and out of psychiatric hospitals most of her life, and her death suggested that it was the result of suicide. She took an overdose of barbiturates, which may have been accidental, but many people considered that it was probably suicide. But you can see, and today we would probably recognise that she had borderline personality disorder. So the symptoms, the features of this condition are the person has unstable relationships right through their lives. They don't really make meaningful, lasting, intimate relationships. They also show impulsivity, starting projects but changing directions frequently, extreme mood swings, so that they're either totally elated and thinking the world is perfect and treating their friends as if they're perfect, describing them as soulmates and as angels, all good, or swinging to the opposite extreme, where they, even within a matter of minutes, treat the other person as if they're the devil, as if they are all bad and pure evil. So there's no stability in terms of the emotional connection in their relationships. They often have extreme outbursts of anger and are very suicidal in terms of their behaviour. Some people have suggested that what happens in borderline personality disorder is that the person uses suicidal threats to get attention. And of course, if you're on the receiving end of someone who says that they're going to kill themselves, it's very distressing. And the idea that somebody may be just doing this in order to get attention, I think you would immediately see is not very empathic. It's a horrible thing to hear that someone might do this. It will fill you with anxiety and worry. What should you do with this information? And the idea that minutes later they may just be acting in a jovial, light-hearted way, having given you that information, suggests that they're not really being very sensitive to their listener. And when you talk to people with borderline personality disorder, they talk about not really knowing who they are, so identity confusion, feeling an inner sense of emptiness, that they don't really feel alive, and having this extreme fear of abandonment, and that can drive them to behave in extreme ways, where they cling to friendships, saying, please never leave me, please tell me that you love me, and if you can't provide all of the affirmation that they need, then they'll treat you as if you're heartless and evil. So you can see this extreme personality. I've tried to give you a little portrait. And the question is, how do we understand how people develop borderline personality disorder? Turns out that it was a former Cambridge student. He was at Trinity College, John Bowlby, who many of you have heard of, who went on to work at the Tavistock Clinic in London, a psychoanalyst and an ethologist, who came up with a very good understanding of some of these personality disorders. So he noted that many people who had that kind of profile in their adulthood had often had very difficult early upbringing, early abuse and neglect. He particularly focused on maternal neglect and rejection by a caregiver or a mother figure, seemed to characterize a lot of the outcomes of people with personality disorders. And he developed, as many of you know, a psychological theory called attachment theory, the idea that we all need to form secure attachments to a caregiver in early childhood, and that those of us who succeed in this, maybe because the conditions are right, go on to have emotionally stable lives right through our lives, and those who had insecure attachments early on go on to show a pattern of insecurity and emotional instability right through their lives. His famous study was of 44 so-called juvenile thieves. He was looking at adolescent delinquents who had been in and out of care homes right from young, from early childhood. Many of them had had 50 or 100 different foster families, so no security or stability in their early life, and who had got into trouble with the law. That's how he started studying them, as delinquents. But what the way he described them was as affectionless psychopaths. These were individuals who would do anything to get what they wanted, didn't really care about other people, and had very shallow relationships. So they would willingly become fostered into a new family, treating their new foster family in superficially affectionate ways, but actually had no real feelings for their foster families, or indeed for their carers or any other relationships. Affectionless psychopaths. So I think this underlines the importance of early environment, and it's gone on to be a very powerful, important theory in making predictions from even as early as the first year of life of which children will be self-confident, achieving, and stable in their lives, and which children will have emotional difficulties and be less confident. Now, there's a second personality disorder, which is a bit different to the first one, which I think, again, is marked by lack of empathy, antisocial personality disorder. This is a little bit different, and I'm sorry to, you know, early on a Saturday morning, be introducing you to these rather unattractive personalities. But these are individuals who break the law for their own gain. They are really only interested in themselves. They lie to get what they want. They can be very aggressive, and that's why you've got an image there of somebody in jail, because many of these individuals end up in the prison system. They have a so-called reckless disregard for other people's feelings, and most importantly, when they're arrested or get in trouble after having mugged an old lady or shown other forms of lack of empathy, they show no remorse, no guilt, no empathy for their victim. So antisocial personality disorder. And a sort of subset of that is what we would call psychopaths. And here you can see a little photo, just not very clear photo, from Silence of the Lambs, that really chilling movie, where people are, well, in this case, an individual is willing to do anything to get what he wants. And you can see that the The extreme of physical aggression isn't always part of the nature of what we call psychopaths. They can be superficially charming. They may not be outwardly physically violent, but they don't seem to show any anxiety at hurting another person or any guilt if they have hurt another person, and they behave in entirely selfish, egocentric ways. Part of the diagnosis of this personality disorder, as you can see at the bottom, is a lack of insight. That critically, what the psychiatrist is looking for is that the individual doesn't seem to be aware of how somebody else might feel or the impact of their own behaviour. So they can act in a cruel way and not seem to have any insight into what this is doing to another person. And I find this very interesting, this idea that our empathy is intimately tied to our ability to reflect. You know, we have this word insight. We don't really know what it means, but we all know what it refers to when we think about what we're doing and how our behaviour can be regulated. But it's a process that I think is neglected in terms of scientific understanding, and also very much tied to the emotion of guilt. Some of us might think, is guilt an unnecessary emotion? Well, it turns out to be extremely necessary, because without guilt, I would argue, you can't really experience empathy. Somebody who is free of guilt is literally free to do anything they like to another person. There are no brakes on your behaviour. And in a study conducted at the National Institutes of Mental Health in Washington, D.C., by James Blair, he looked at psychopaths in terms of whether they show any physiological response to another person's distress. I'm sorry to put up some numbers in front of you, but what he did was he had a group of psychopaths and then a control group of people who weren't psychopaths, and he showed them either photographs of threatening stimuli, like guns, or photographs of distressing stimuli, so a child crying, for example, where you see the emotions very visibly on another person's face, or neutral stimuli. And what you can see is that he measured something called galvanic skin response, so how much you sweat and you show an emotional reaction in terms of your heart rate when you see each of these kinds of pictures. And what you can see here in these results, I think they're very clear, is that the psychopaths showed less of a response, less of a physiological reaction when they were looking at images of distress. So this suggests that their basic physiology is wired up differently to the rest of us, that when they are faced with someone else in distress, they don't get the normal feelings of wanting to do something about it. I've only got two more examples, you'll be pleased to know, of these rather, I think, extreme and negative outcomes of what happens when you lose your empathy. This is narcissistic personality disorder, so it's another kind of personality disorder. And it's named after the Greek myth, Narcissus, who famously fell in love with his own reflection. But this idea really is of an individual who really only cares about themselves, and often thinks that they're much more important than other people. So they try to set themselves above other people, even at the expense of other people's feelings. So they may have very grandiose ideas of their own importance, and all of their behaviour seems to be driven by how can they get more success and more power. They believe that they're special, that they don't need to be subject to the other laws of society that everybody else is subject to. So they can evade taxes, they can jump queues, they can go to the front because they're only thinking about themselves, rather than thinking about how a society as a whole might work if everybody acted in a selfish way. They believe that they have some kind of sense of entitlement and won't stop at exploiting other people, and often sound and behave in a very arrogant way. So you can see these are all different kinds of empathy disorder. And although psychiatrists will look at patients and decide which of these diagnostic labels fits the patient, I would argue that actually what's going on in the brain, and I'm going to show you a little bit of evidence for this, what's going on in the brain is that the key centres neurologically that enable us to experience empathy are all underactive, reduced, or in some way impaired in individuals with these kinds of personality disorders. Now, I want to sort of bring in a fifth example, which I think doesn't quite fit the other four. So I work in the Autism Research Centre here at the university, and I've been puzzling over the fact that these individuals too lack empathy, but they seem to be very different to those personality disorders that I've been describing. So as many of you know, it's a neurological condition, autism, and there's a subgroup called Asperger's syndrome. and these individuals are very confused by other people. When they try to read other people's emotions, they are literally confused. It's almost like trying to decode a foreign language, that they look around them and they can see everybody else socialising, engaging in small talk, understanding humour and jokes and irony and many kinds of communication. And they often describe themselves as if they're Martians from another planet. It's almost as if there's a wall between them and other people, that they can't form that connection with other people. So you can see that their social difficulties are characterised by a whole host of features. They often say the wrong thing, that they treat language as if you can decode it literally, when a lot of our language is figurative, metaphorical, full of sarcasm or hidden innuendos. And all of that just goes right over their heads. So they often find it difficult to put themselves into another person's shoes, imagine another person's perspective, and may even come across as if their own perspective is the only valid one. These individuals, I would argue, also lack empathy, but not in that same negative way that we've seen earlier. I'll go on to explain why, but first of all, some examples here of where if you test people with autism or Asperger's syndrome, about whether they can even label the basic emotions. Can they match a word to describe a face? You can see that even if the task is as simple as recognising disgust or sadness or happiness, people with autism in grey are performing at a slightly lower level than a control group on all of these emotions. I think the exception here was the emotion of surprise. So even at this very basic level, they're having trouble reading another person's feelings from their facial expressions. And if you try to test this at a more complex level, so where you ask people to to pick which word best describes what the person in the photograph is thinking or feeling, you've got these four words here. This is a test designed for adults. The correct answer on this particular photo is dispirited. She's a bit sad. It turns out that people with Asperger's syndrome score lower than the two other groups, typical men and typical women. some of you spotted that there's a small but possibly important difference between men and women in terms of reading emotions. Here I'm focusing on people with autism or Asperger's syndrome who are showing extreme difficulties on this task. You can also measure this in terms of questionnaires, that if you ask people to just simply endorse whether they agree or disagree with statements which are all about social sensitivity, how easily you can pick up whether you're doing the right thing or saying the right thing, you can see that people with Asperger's syndrome score much lower than men and women in the general population. So by their self-report, they're very confused about how to behave socially. And you can see that this, when we look at these tests, whether they're that tests of emotion recognition or those questionnaires measuring empathy, we get that bell curve, that so-called normal distribution in the general population. Some people are much better at it than others. Most of us cluster somewhere in the middle. And what we're interested in is individuals who are right down here, which is where we find people with autism and Asperger's syndrome, who are really struggling to understand what empathy is all about. But I mentioned that I don't think autism is entirely negative. Unlike those personality disorders, the psychopaths, those with borderline personality disorder, and others, because Asperger's syndrome and autism often entail another side, that as well as their problems with empathy, they can have great gifts in something called systemizing, understanding how systems work. I'm not going to spend too long on this because it's a slight tangent, but I just simply mention that people with Asperger's syndrome are often fascinated by systems, analysing systems or building systems, whether they're mechanical ones, becoming fascinated by a rotating fan, mechanical fan, or natural systems like the types of leaves on trees, abstract systems like mathematics, or at a more concrete level, train timetables, or taxonomic systems like catalogues. And all of these systems are rule-based. They follow rules or laws. And when you systemize, you're trying to understand how the system works to predict how it behaves. People with Asperger's syndrome seem to be far more comfortable with these lawful, predictable, rule-based systems, even though they're struggling to understand people. Turns out that systemizing itself is normally distributed. Some of us are much quicker at understanding systems than others. That people on the autistic spectrum, those with Asperger's, may be seen up at the high level of systemizing. So here's an example here where we've tested children with Asperger's syndrome on little tests of physics, and it turns out that they do better than a comparison group on understanding, in this case, a mechanical system, even though they have a lot of difficulty in putting themselves into someone else's shoes. I mention this simply because the idea that all of these examples of empathy disorder are necessarily negative turns out not to be true, that for people with Asperger's syndrome, despite their difficulties with empathy, they seem to have gifts in understanding systematic information. I want to get back to empathy, though, because we now know quite a bit about the brain basis of empathy. And it turns out that empathy isn't located in one part of the brain alone. It's a network of regions in the brain. And I'm not going to run through all of these 10 or so regions, but I've highlighted two of them. So let's start off with the amygdala, which you can see here. Let's just pick it out for you. Just over there. So the way this drawing is done, there's a sort of translucency to it, because actually you can't see the amygdala from the outside. It's hidden from sight. But you can see, as if we're looking through the brain, at where it's located. And some people think of the amygdala, which is a subcortical structure, as the emotion center of the brain. It's very active when you're thinking about other people's feelings, but also when you're having the experience of emotion yourself. And people with those various personality disorders I mentioned earlier, and with autism, show abnormalities in the function of their amygdala. The other area that I wanted to mention, which is very connected to the amygdala, is the prefrontal cortex. So if this is the brain looked at sideways, and there's the frontal lobe, this area coloured in here is the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. And looking at the brain from underneath, you can see it shaded there so that you can see there are two sides to it, a left and a right side. And again, this seems to be strongly connected to empathy. When you put children who are like the ones Bowlby studied, those juvenile delinquents, sometimes called children with conduct disorder, into the scanner, and you show them images of somebody else experiencing pain. Here we've got, as you can see, a piano lid closing on someone's fingers, quite painfully. What Dossetti and others found working in Chicago was that children who are delinquents, who are a little bit out of control in terms of their empathy, actually show more activity in a different region of the brain, the ventral striatum, which is usually associated with reward. When we experience pleasure, we have activity in that region, and these children are actually deriving some pleasure at seeing somebody else's pain. So the information coming out of the brain scans of children who are well on the way to developing an empathy disorder actually fits this idea that instead of the normal reaction of sympathy or compassion to someone else's pain, they're actually reacting inappropriately. And some of you may have heard of the discovery of the mirror neuron system in the brain, the idea that parts of the brain are active not only when you perform an action, but when you see somebody else performing the same action. So if I lift up this glass, I'm performing a particular action, but if you look at my brain whilst I'm watching somebody else performing the same action, the very same neurons are firing. That's called the mirror neuron system. And many of the regions that are involved in empathy seem to also be part of that mirror neuron system. We learned quite a lot from neurology about how you can lose your empathy. And this case is perhaps one of the most well-known cases in neurology of Phineas Gage, who was working on the railways in the States in 1848, when he had an awful accident where a sharp pole that he was using as part of his work on the railways went right up underneath his eye and right through his brain and came out the other side. And amazingly, he didn't die. He actually went on to live for about 12 years. But Hannah Damasio, who's a neurologist in Iowa in the States, analysed his brain, because it was left after he died for scientists to study, to see exactly which parts of the brain had been damaged. And it turns out to be, again, that same region, the left medial frontal cortex. But the most important thing is what happened to him as a person. So interestingly, despite this really horrific brain damage, he didn't lose any of his intelligence. He was still able to do most of his everyday and even his work-related activities. But everybody commented that his personality had changed, that whereas before he'd been a polite, considerate individual, he became very rude, very offensive, and very socially inappropriate. So this kind of single case example from neurology has also helped us understand which parts of the brain are involved in empathy. I want to sort of bring this back to evolution, because it turns out that although Bowlby was right that our early environment plays an important part in fostering our ability for relationships and therefore our empathy, there are elements of our biology too that do so. So here we have a study that our research group has been involved in, where we look at hormones in the womb, in the amniotic fluid, measured when women who are pregnant have something called amniocentesis. Many of you know what that is, but that's where a long needle is introduced into the amniotic fluid, and where you can sample some of that fluid. So we look at the so-called male hormone, testosterone, although both sexes have testosterone. Males have more of it than females, but actually, again, there's a bell curve in terms of how much testosterone we each have. And we follow up these babies after they're born to see whether the amount of hormone in the womb, which is thought to influence your brain development, has any effect on your behaviour and particularly your empathy. So we've been following children from pregnancy. These children are now 8 years old. They're running around Cambridge, and we invite them into our lab. We've given them that test of empathy, looking at photographs of faces, and they have to pick which word best describes what the person in the photo is thinking or feeling. And here I hope you agree that he's interested in something. What you can see is that if this is the hormone, the range, and here is your score on the photograph test, the line goes downwards, which means that the higher your levels of fetal testosterone, prenatal testosterone, the worse your score on this test of empathy. So who'd have thought that a molecule, the amount of hormone that you have before you're born, might influence your ability to read emotions in somebody else's face years later. It turns out that that there's a hormonal basis to, or at least an association to this ability, just as much as there are postnatal social influences. This is another example from the same study where we ask mothers to fill in a questionnaire. You can see some examples, just rating how empathic they think their child is. And then, completely blind to the mothers, we also have this information about how much hormone, testosterone, was the baby producing before the baby was born. And once again, you can see the same pattern, that the line goes downwards, meaning that the more testosterone the baby was producing prenatally, the lower their score on this test of empathy 8 years later. So it's an example of how your hormones can influence your empathy. But we've also recently completed a study looking at genes for empathy, because all of those disorders that I mentioned earlier seem to run in families. Asperger's syndrome, certainly, but also psychopathic personality disorder, even borderline personality disorder, seems to run in families, suggesting there may be not just a social familial element, but possibly a genetic element. And twin studies bear that out. And what we've recently found is a set of genes. These are just the names of them, for those of you who are following the exciting field of genetics and its impact on human behaviour. A set of genes that are all correlated with your score on the empathy quotient. And for those of you who are interested, these first two genes are involved in regulating testosterone. This is a gene that regulates the receptor for a neurotransmitter called GABA. This one here, CNR1, is the cannabinoid receptor, so a receptor in the brain that responds to cannabinoids. So when, for example, you experience reward from smoking cannabis, that part of your brain would be active, but it's the same part of the brain that's also responsive to other kinds of rewards, including social rewards, for example, seeing somebody else smiling. So there seems to be a whole set of genes that are correlated with how much empathy you show, and we're starting to piece those parts of the puzzle together. But it does raise, just to close, this interesting idea that empathy may be the result of evolution. If there's a partly genetic basis to our empathy, given that evolution operates on genes, natural selection of genes, that empathy may not be a uniquely human ability, and we may be able to see examples of it in other species. So Franz de Waal is a primatologist that many of you will have heard of, who argues that actually other species are capable of empathy, and he particularly looks at monkeys and apes, and his evidence for this is that you can see other species showing these kinds of behaviours, that they share food, they sometimes help one another, and there's some famous examples of chimpanzees helping one another to escape over a high wall by lifting each other to do so. They show consolation. So when primates are in fights, as male monkeys and apes often are, the loser is often consoled by other members of the troop that the one who loses the fight may, instead of being isolated, be approached by other monkeys and given some comfort in the form of a cuddle or just a physical gesture or stroking of them. And obviously they read each other's emotions in terms of being able to recognise each other's facial expressions of fear or invitations to approach. So his argument is that you can see very primitive examples of empathy even in monkeys. And there's a very famous experiment by Masserman at Northwestern University that was published in 1964 of rhesus monkeys who were trained to pull a chain to get food. And then they changed the contingencies so that when the animal pulled the chain to get food, they would also see that another monkey was getting an electric shock. And what they found in this really startling experiment was that monkeys refused to pull the chain to get food if the other monkey was also receiving an electric shock at the same time. And there was, if you read this remarkable experiment, there are descriptions of some monkeys refusing to cooperate with getting food for as long as 12 days. So they were literally starving themselves if it meant that getting food for themselves was at the expense of somebody else experiencing pain, suggesting that other monkeys, other species, may be capable of degrees of empathy. But I think there are limits to the kinds of empathy we see in other species. We don't see elaborate examples of deception, where you could argue that's the cognitive part of empathy, being able to imagine someone else's thoughts and even manipulate what someone else might believe. You don't see what you see in humans, even from the age of 12 to 14 months old, the pointing gesture where one young animal is trying to direct somebody else to share their experience. You don't see that in other species. And nor do you even see the example of begging, where if you approach a young human child and put your hand out in a begging gesture, they'll immediately understand that what you want is for them to give you something. So they're reading your mind through your gesture. But if you do that to other species, they just don't seem to get it. So there seem to be limits to how much other animals can read other people's intentions. And I once went to a fantastic lecture over in the Lady Mitchell Hall here on this site by Dorothy Cheney, who's a primatologist, who was describing vervet monkeys who sometimes have to swim through flooded rice fields, and they'll have the young monkey clinging to their fur, and the mother monkey will swim right through a flooded field with her head above the water, even though her baby is actually underwater, and many of these mothers lose their babies because they drown, as a really striking example of how, in this case, monkeys can't necessarily take the perspective of their offspring to realise that even though they are okay, they have what they need because of their physical position. Their offspring may have a different perspective, and it may have literally a different outcome. I want to sort of finish by saying that empathy isn't static, that we have been trying to teach empathy to people on the autistic spectrum because we think it's important. And you can see here that using a DVD where you have the opportunity to look at actors showing different facial expressions, when people on the autistic spectrum have a chance to study facial expressions and learn them in a more systematic way, the group of people with autism who had the opportunity to do so actually improved much more than a group of people with autism who didn't. So this was over a relatively short period of using this DVD called Mind Reading, suggesting that although empathy may be partly neurological and even genetic, like anything, learning can make a difference. So I'm going to finish with drawing some conclusions. And although we had the late start, maybe we can have a short time for comments or questions. But I want to really convey my view that empathy is vital for relationships and vital for society. It's often an overlooked or neglected quality that we have, and it can be the solution to many difficulties, whether it's in one-to-one relationships or between nations, that rather than resorting to legal or even military solutions for resolving conflicts and misunderstandings, empathy can go a long way. I've also outlined that there are many ways that you can lose your empathy, and psychiatry is sadly full of examples of clinical conditions, these personality disorders, where you lose your empathy in devastating and negative ways. But I've also shown that there's at least one clinical condition, autism or Asperger's, where despite the difficulties with empathy, there can also be gifts associated with that condition. And finally, to conclude, our early environment is no doubt important for the development of empathy. I don't want us to suddenly think it's all in our genes. It makes a huge amount of difference if we provide stable environments for our children and loving, affectionate environments for our children. But there does seem to be a biological and even genetic component to our empathy, suggesting that empathy is in part the result of evolution. And I'm going to stop there, invite you to visit our website if you want any more information about anything I've talked about. Thank you very much.